morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The annual festival of Earth Day was on a moon day this year, 22 April, with a nearly full Luna face beaming down on Mother Gaia. I start today's program with a springtime ritual that is verifyingly toxic as to be justifiably quarantined universally. I wrote it for my former newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, and have read it on this program more than once on the occasion of annual vernal rituals of poisoning other species. I call it the Sprays of Spring. And I start with a quote from Rachel Carson. The chemical war is never won, and all life is caught in its crossfire. Sweet spring buds, blooms, and blossoms. Sounds of birds and crop dusters. Skies shot with billowy clouds and mists of pesticides. The eternal war against insects and weeds is renewed. We are dusted, misted, sprayed, hosed, and powdered with some of the deadliest chemicals ever conceived to kill tickle worms, aphids, leafhoppers, spider mites, cabbage worms, spittle bugs, potato beetles, carpenter ants, Japanese beetles, corn earwing worms, grasshoppers, codling moths, blister beetles, as well as unwanted plants and weeds. We are exposed to insecticides, miticides, acaricides, nematicides, fungicides, bactericides, avicides, herbicides, rodenticides, pesticides, molluscicides, and predicides, plus desiccants and defoliants. These pesticides kill by simply touching insects. They kill when swallowed or by being taken into the blood of animals or the sap of plants. They kill through inhalation or by being otherwise absorbed. Selective pesticides are designed to kill only certain kinds of plants, insects, or animals. Non-selective pesticides kill most plants, insects, and animals. These chemicals are sprayed by aircraft, from tanks on trucks, from knapsack containers, hoses, and handheld sprayers. They are dusted, misted, or sprayed over farms, forests, and gardens, and are also used on school playgrounds, golf courses, the lawns of public buildings, and along roadsides. They drift in forms of dust and mist, or move with soil particles by erosion. They leach through the soil into lakes, rivers, and streams, and are carried as residues on crops and livestock, or evaporate and move with air currents. Of course, we are not only assaulted by pesticides from air, land, and water through inhalation or permeation. We eat and drink them also in fruits, vegetables, meats, and milk. 1 billion pounds of these poisons are applied annually within the United States, and it is virtually impossible to live anywhere in the country without being exposed, in many areas saturated. Wildlife is contaminated, food chains are affected, habitat is destroyed, and human life is endangered. Pesticides are linked to cancer, nervous system damage, degenerative changes in liver and kidneys, fetal injury, miscarriages, birth defects, genetic mutations, and other serious diseases. pesticides occur in mother's milk and in the tissues of unborn children. Exposure to these chemicals causes irreversible changes that alter genetic materials in cells permanently. Pesticide residues and their breakdown products are routinely found in blood and urine samples from both urban and rural residents nationwide. Pesticide residues capable of causing cancer and mutations show up in human sperm samples. A study by the National Academy of Sciences concluded that 28 pesticides known to cause cancer and found in foods might cause more than 1 million cancers over the next 70 years, and the Natural Resources Defense Council, a private environmental group, reports that children's exposure to pesticides and potential harm from these chemicals in food is 6 to 12 times greater than that of adults. Rachel Carson, who sounded the alarm about the dangers of pesticides in her 1961 book, Silent Spring, called these poisons biocides. There are two kinds of biocides, botanical or organic, and synthetic or human-made. Though the first are dangerous enough, powdered arsenic has been used for centuries and has a significant death toll. The synthetic chemicals are unsurpassed in their toxicity. Initial development of these chemicals was during World War II, following the discovery of DDT. Ironically, the growth of the synthetic pesticide industry started in the war years by testing these chemicals on insects as possible agents to kill human enemies. The government regulatory process is a failure as much in pesticide abuse as Pentagon contracts. The political and commercial copulative relationship between agencies and industry rules out any effectively honest regulation of pesticide use and abuse. In fact, government agencies rely on manufacturers' data about pesticide safety with the ingenuous claim the process saves taxpayers' money. Other information about toxicity levels or research is either suppressed or often falsified. The standard used by both government and industry is a so-called safe level of toxicity, though it has been determined there is no safe level of exposure to anything that causes cancer or mutations, which is used short of outright banning of a substance and is generally assumed to not cause immediate harm. As these chemicals are new when first labeled, there is no other method of determining long-range or cumulative effects than wait and see. Even when a chemical is harmful to test animals, industry and government officials say they cannot be sure they are harmful to humans. Labeling information is itself suspect, particularly claims that a pesticide is safe or that its ingredients are non-poisonous. Whenever a substance is banned or restricted, which is seldom, unrestricted use of stocks on hand are usually allowed to be sold and used while a number of equally toxic chemicals that are in the wait-and-see stage are put into use as replacements. Chemicals that are singled out as a result of harmful effects are rarely equated with the multiple effects of cumulative exposure to dozens of pesticides, often simultaneously. Not only has the ingenious development of synthetic pesticides outrun the knowledge of their disastrous effects on living organisms, but residues from their manufacture accumulate in largely unregulated dumps, where some break down into even deadlier compounds that seep into land, water, and air. Carol Van Strum of Five Forks, Oregon, in her 1983 book, A Bitter Fog, Herbicides and Human Rights, echoed a call by Rachel Carson for a constitutional amendment to protect citizens from environmental poisoning. To those who bear the risk, she wrote, exposure to poisons is a matter of life and death. Decisions about poisons, which disrupt the basic mechanism of life and the biological integrity of future generations, raise profound moral questions. Society cannot afford to entrust such decisions to corporate or political entities that exempt themselves from the restraints of morality and ethics. And that was Carol Van Strum. Current law requires a person threatened with exposure to a toxic chemical to prove that irreparable harm will result, while the information for such proof is kept secret or not available because adequate research has not been done, not to mention revisions of studies that are watered down to support the toxic chemical industry. Van Strum believes, quote, that a society insisting on its right of informed consent would quickly redirect pest control toward non-poisonous methods of integrated pest management, unquote. Pest control, she writes, would adopt nature's system of checks and balances essential to a true democracy. Rachel Carson said that the only reason the Bill of Rights contains no guarantee that a citizen shall be secure against lethal poisons distributed, whether by private individuals or government officials, is because our forefathers, quote, despite their considerable wisdom and foresight, could conceive of no such problem. An informed consent amendment is already provided a constitutional basis by the Ninth Amendment, which states that in addition to the specific rights enumerated in the Constitution, there are, quote, others retained by the people, unquote. History, however, has shown that specific rights must necessarily be specified if they are to be upheld. Nothing could be more specific than two questions posed by Van Strum. Do I or do I not have the right to know the effects of the stuff you intend to expose me to? Do you or do you not have to get my permission before exposing me to it? A constitutional amendment would not be an instant or complete solution to the problems of pesticides, and government and industry will spend millions of dollars fighting it. But, as Van Strum says, in opposing informed consent, government and industry would have to admit that toxic exposure does occur and that people have no right either to know about it or to stop it. They would have to convince the public that ignorance and helplessness are preferable to knowledge and control. And that was Van Strum. In the meantime, the insects we attempt to eradicate continue to build resistance to pesticides, which provokes development of ever more toxic chemicals. For humans to build resistance will take hundreds of generations at roughly three generations a century. New insect generations occur in a matter of days or weeks. The chemical control of plants and insects turns out to be a greater menace to ourselves than to its targets. Future historians may well be amazed by our own distorted sense of proportion, Rachel Carson wrote in Silent Spring. How could intelligent beings seek to control an unwanted species by a method that contaminated the entire environment and brought the threat of disease and death even to their own kind? Rachel Carson asks. And that was The Sprays of Spring, which I wrote for my former newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, and with gratitude to Rachel Carson and Carol Van Strom, also to Mary Sellen and Dee Miotal of Ocean, and Helen Patty Hill, whose articles on pesticides in previous issues of the North Coast Times Eagle provided the essential research for this particular article. And now, the Supreme Court seems poised to allow local laws that penalize homelessness. By Abby Van Sickle. And she wrote this for the New York Times. A majority of the Supreme Court appeared inclined this past Monday to uphold a series of local ordinances that allowed a small Oregon city to ban homeless people from sleeping or camping in public spaces. The justices seemed split along ideological lines in the case, which has sweeping implications for how the country deals with the growing homelessness crisis. In a lengthy and, at times, fiery argument that lasted almost 2.5 hours, questioning from the justices reflected the complexity of the homelessness debate. They weighed the status of poverty and the civil rights of homeless people against the ability of cities to clear public spaces like parks and sidewalks to address concerns about health and safety. They wrestled with what lines could be drawn to regulate homelessness and, crucially, who should make those rules. The conservative majority appeared sympathetic to arguments by the city of Grants Pass, Oregon, that homelessness is a complicated issue best handled by local lawmakers and communities, not judges. The liberal justices strongly resisted that notion. Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr. calmly cut to the central point that seemed to resonate with the conservative wing. Why would you think that these 9 people are the best people to judge and weigh those policy judgments? Quote, unquote. In impassioned questioning, the liberal justices pushed back sharply on the city's argument that homelessness was not a status protected under the 8th Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. Could you criminalize the status of homelessness? Justice Elena Kagan asked the city's lawyer, Theon D. Evangelist. Well, I don't think that homelessness is a status like drug addiction, Ms. Evangelist responded. Homelessness is a status, Justice Kagan replied. It's the status of not having a home. The issue of how far local governments can go to regulate homelessness has given rise to unusual alliances across the political spectrum, with some leaders of left-leaning cities and states joining with conservative groups to urge the justices to clarify the extent of their legal authority in clearing encampments that have proliferated across the West in recent years. Many leaders of Western states and cities have contended that decisions by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 9th Circuit, which oversees 9 Western states, have been interpreted in ways that have limited the flexibility of governments to tackle the problem. The case stems from a series of local ordinances in Grants Pass, a town of about 40,000 in southern Oregon. City officials stepped up enforcement of local laws in 2013 after residents began to complain about people sleeping, urinating, and defecating outside. Three homeless residents of Grants Pass challenged those ordinances in 2018, arguing that the city had violated the Eighth Amendment. Grants Pass contended that the Eighth Amendment was the wrong framework because it is typically aimed at punishments, not at laws. It added that a Supreme Court ruling striking down its ordinances would set a troubling precedent that would tie the hands of local governments around the country and fuel sprawling encampments. The case is among the last to be argued this Supreme Court term, which means that it is unlikely to be decided before late June or perhaps in early July, since the Supreme Court now has a backlog of pending decisions in major cases. As arguments were underway, about 100 demonstrators protested outside the court, chanting, "SCOTUS, now's the time. Homelessness is not a crime," and holding signs that read, "Housing justice" and "Housing is a human right." Kelsey B. Corcoran, the lawyer representing the homeless plaintiffs, asserted that the use of the Eighth Amendment in the case was appropriate and therefore an issue the court was suited to address. "I don't think there's any question that being poor is a status," she said. "It's a status that can change over time, and at that point, you wouldn't be part of the class, but I don't think it changes the fact that it is a status." In heated questioning with the lawyer for the city, Justice Kagan pointed to the city's ordinances that allow the authorities to ticket people for sleeping with bedding in public, asking whether cities could outlaw other basic human needs like breathing. "Sleeping is a biological necessity," Justice Kagan said. "It's sort of like breathing. I mean, you could say breathing is conduct, too, but presumably you would not think that it's okay to criminalize breathing in public, and for a homeless person who has no place to go, sleeping in public is kind of like breathing in public." Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson made a similar analogy, asking whether a city could prohibit eating in public because of concerns about sanitation, trash, and rodents. "Most people would be fine," she said, "because they could just eat at restaurants or somewhere indoors, but not everyone. Some people don't have that option," Justice Jackson said. "They have to eat in public because they are unhoused and they cannot afford to go to a restaurant." Ms. Evangelist said she did not think that such laws would violate the Eighth Amendment, and bringing the discussion back to Grants Pass and its ordinances, added that the city was arguing that states and local governments should drive policymaking. "We think that it is harmful for people to be living in public spaces, on streets and in parks," Ms. Evangelist said. "Whatever bedding materials, when humans are living in these conditions, we think that's not compassionate and that there's no dignity in that." That elicited sharp commentary from Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who said, "Where do we put them if every city, every village, every town lacks compassion and passes a law identical to this? Where are they supposed to sleep? Are they supposed to kill themselves not sleeping?" Several conservative justices seemed skeptical of the practicalities of following the rule laid out by the lower appeals court. The appeals court had determined that a city could not penalize people for being involuntarily homeless if the city did not have enough shelter beds for its homeless population. The justices seemed particularly concerned with how to decide whether a city had enough shelter beds and who would be responsible for sorting out such complex issues day to day. I think one of the questions is, who takes care of it on the ground? Justice Brett M. Kavanaugh asked a lawyer for the federal government, Edwin S. Needler. Is it going to be federal judges, or is it the local jurisdictions with working with the nonprofits and religious organizations? The Biden administration had joined the case, siding with neither party, arguing that Grant's past laws probably violated the Eighth Amendment, but that the lower court erred by not requiring an examination into each homeless person's circumstances. Several justices wrestled with how to think of someone's state of being versus their conduct. The plaintiff's argument rests in part on a 1962 case, Robinson versus California, in which the Supreme Court held that laws imposing penalties on people for narcotics addiction violated the Eighth Amendment because they punished a state of being, not a specific action, like drug possession or sale. In a similar fashion, the plaintiffs contend Grant's Pass is punishing people for being involuntarily homeless, not for specific actions. That argument held sway in a separate case, Martin versus Boise, in 2018. In that case, a panel of judges from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled that Boise, Idaho, had violated the constitutional rights of homeless people by imposing criminal penalties for sleeping and camping outdoors, even though the city did not have enough shelter beds. Ms. Evangelist argued that the appeals court's approach had proven unworkable. Cities are struggling to apply arbitrary shifting standards in the field, she said, adding that the Supreme Court should end the Ninth Circuit's failed experiment, which has fueled the spread of encampments while harming those it purports to protect. Chief Justice Roberts grappled with what was the best tack, asking whether homelessness was truly a state of being in the same way that being addicted to drugs is. What is the analytic approach to deciding whether something's a status or a situation of conduct? He asked. You can remove the homeless status in an instant if you move to a shelter or situations otherwise change. And of course, it could be moved the other way as well if you're kicked out of the shelter, whatever. And that was an article in the New York Times. Supreme Court seems poised to allow local laws that penalize homelessness. And it was written by Abby Van Sickle, who covers the United States Supreme Court for the New York Times. She is a lawyer and has an extensive background in investigative reporting. This is Michael McCusker. Jack Harris has been the pilot of this program.